This is why you're horrible. This is why everyone hates you. And this is why I'm here. You made me necessary.
Serious question. All right, level with me, guys. Are we in fact living in a simulated reality? Is this whole thing a simulation? I can't tell anymore. Some guy from Africa named... I'm not even going to try to pronounce that first name. It's a word salad. But his last name is Wiley, so I'll call him Wiley. So Wiley is commissioned to paint a presidential portrait of Obama. Nothing unusual about that. Then, what is the leading national news story for the day? That there is a giant sperm cell hidden in the painting on Obama's forehead, tracing down the forehead like a vein almost, and then curving into the hair, so that the sperm head looks like a clump of hair. So I ask you, are we in fact living in a simulation? Because the underground theory that when CERN turned on the Hadron Collider, it created a branched off version of Earth, things deviated and branched off into a new reality, that's starting to look more and more plausible every day. Seriously, look around you and tell me, when was the last time that news had a normal, a comprehensibly normal, sane, civilized tone? And you can't blame all this on alternative media. Because at this point, they're only reacting to the insanity of the mainstream media. If legacy media dies, like CNN, who just laid off, like, I think 50 to 100 workers. If CNN and all these other alphabet soup news agencies, they go under, they go belly up. It is through no fault of alternative media doing a better job at getting the information out there than those legacy agencies of the news that we relied on, you know, in more innocent times. So this Obama sperm painting story, I can't believe I just said that out loud. Who could have ever dreamed this up in a fiction, in some satire? So this Obama sperm story. Someone took the painstaking effort of looking into Wiley's back catalog, his portfolio of previous art, and it turns out that he has a history of incorporating sperm into his works. They call it a motif. Now, sure enough, Snopes is on the case, which I called with a friend, and I said, watch, they're either going to call it mostly true or mostly false, because they always give themselves plenty of wiggle room, no pun intended. So I go to check it out, and surprisingly, they actually committed to a straightforward answer that it was false. The claim that the official portrait of former President Barack Obama contained secretly placed images of sperm cells, including one on his forehead, false. It's been given a rating of false. And I'm going to quote now from this article. It was perhaps inevitable that controversy would surround the unveiling of President Obama's official portrait in February 2018. Given that it was painted by Kehinde Wiley, a gay African-American artist who is also a self-professed provocateur. Right, so, because why would a provocateur incorporate sexual fluid into their art, right? And I don't know what being gay and African-American has to do with it. It goes on, the internet bristled with reproductions of two of Wiley's previous works depicting black women holding the severed heads of white people, a tableau that some decried as racist. Well, there's nothing at all racist about holding severed white people heads, right? Even as conservative pundits went on about supposedly detecting representations of sperm cells in Obama's portrait. There's a grammatical error in this sentence. One of Snopes' bots needs to really get on that. Then they quote from the lead scum lord, according to them, Sean Hannity. Included on this page was the magnified image of a small section of the portrait that was also making the rounds via social media. And in this portrait, you can see clear as day in a magnified version of the picture. It is, in fact, a sperm trailing down and curving around as if to hug the side of the forehead where the hair meets. And then they are quick to stoke the fires of outrage by quoting an Alex Jones InfoWars article about it. Because they're really butthurt about Alex Jones' success. And I quote, but although both sources were correct in pointing out that some of Wiley's previous works featured direct and indirect representations of spermatozoa meant to mock the highly charged masculinity that so often characterizes classical Western portraiture. Look at these fucking run-on sentences. This is an embarrassment to people who are cited so often as reliable sources. They leaped a bit too eagerly to the conclusion that a faithfully reproduced vein popping out of Obama's forehead is in fact a giant sperm cell. Clearly, it is nothing of the kind. Actually, clearly, it is definitely the kind. It is every bit the kind. I looked up this image on a different website and saved it and magnified it, and I came to the same conclusion that the original picture allowed me to arrive at. Nor were we able to detect representations of sperm cells anywhere else in the images of Obama's portrait currently available on the internet. So whence did the Obama covered in sperm notion originate? Look no further than the racist trolls sick inhabiting the 4chan message board, where the notion appears to have been birthed earlier that same day. Now, here is their smoking gun, according to Snopes. A photograph of a 4chan post from February 13th. Another episode of the white supremacist Stahanity pipeline of crazy shit. And they're quoting a 4chan poster. While we have been having fun with the really bad official portraits of King and Queen Nigger today, this one takes the cake. While it is well known that the artist who painted the portrait is obsessed with sperm and puts it in all of his work, it appears his portrait of Obama is no exception. You cannot deny that on his forehead there is a representation of a sperm cell. Credit goes to another Anon who questioned what this goo was. Best timeline, lads. All hands on deck. Let's get this in the news. So that's it. Because it originated from 4chan, case closed, it can't be true. Even though the artist has a history of adding this motif to his paintings, you people are fucking retarded. To cite Snopes as a source, if this is the kind of shit they pull when they want to label a news story as false, you're as retarded as them. Then they'll take direct testimony from Mandalay Bay, from people who are actually there, who are reporting weird shit that happened that day and during the concert, including a woman going up to a concert goer and telling her, "You're all gonna die if you don't get out of here." Okay? They take that actual witness testimony and they deride that as mostly false. That's the conclusion they arrive at. With no evidence that they followed up with this girl, that they tracked her down. And even based on what they say she told them, there's not a recanting of testimony. It's just, well, maybe she didn't mean it in the way I thought she did at the time. I'm sorry, but when somebody comes up to me and tells me I'm going to die if I stay somewhere, you know, that's not something that can be taken too many different ways. And so this is why I rail so hard on Snopes. They are not the champion of impartial journalism that many people believe them to be. In fact, I would even wager a supposition, half jokingly, half serious, that the Weekly World News is more credible than fucking Snopes. I don't even care. You can quote me on that, you can clip me on that, and post it wherever you want, on Lefty Poll, wherever, in your little faggoty Facebook feeds, whatever. You can quote me on that. And yeah, I just used the F word again. Liberals in 2018 don't like the F word. So, in a follow-up to my question, are we in fact living in a simulation? We have this gem of news reporting from Kansas City. Angus the dog tries to run for Kansas governor. Now, even jokingly, this is being reckless with what amounts to a fluff piece. Some guy in Kansas is incensed, apparently, that a bunch of teenagers are trying to run for governor. They're getting into the race. Six teenagers are trying to run for the governor's race. And so this guy, Taryn Woolley of Hutchinson, filed paperwork last week to get the ball rolling on a candidate committee for his dog Angus. Now, if we were living in saner times, this Taryn Woolley kid would be using the strange law in Kansas as an opportunity to run himself. And that law is that There is no restriction on who can run. It doesn't matter what age. I don't guess it matters if you're a former inmate. I don't know. Apparently, the law is that there are no restrictions. And so he's coyly trying to get around that by saying, oh, well, if the law is open to anyone, then let my dog run. And he's actually feigning outrage when they come back and say, nope, nope. Sorry, it's not open to canines. If this kid really cared about his town, he would have used whatever resources he had to get the ball rolling on his own campaign instead of his dog. This must be a publicity stunt. He's after the headlines, trying to grab a headline for some fluff piece. If he really cared about the well-being of his town, he would have had some gumption and run on his own platform. But sadly, no, he's going to let his dog get the headlines. And again, it begs the question, simulation? I also wanted to talk very briefly before we get on with the main part of the show about some strange phenomenon I've been noticing in the animal kingdom recently. Most of us have heard of the penguin from last year named, I think, Grapekin in Japan, who fell in love with an anime cutout of a human girl who was supposedly supposed to represent a penguin character in some anime. This penguin, I don't think it ever actually mated with another actual penguin. It died by the side of this anime cutout, this poor penguin. And then I think back to this news story from 2011 when there was the last of the Pinta Galapagos tortoises on the Galapagos Island. There are plenty of other tortoises on that island, but there was only there were very few Pinta tortoises left. He was the last male, this Lonesome George, and they were trying very hard but could never seem to locate another female of that specific subspecies. Now, they tried unsuccessfully to breed poor Lonesome George with other female turtles that were the closest as they could get to the Pinta tortoise. Unfortunately, he did mate, but none of the eggs were ever viable. They just weren't healthy enough to last. They tried this on three different occasions before they just let Lonesome George be lonesome. He liked his solitude away from the other tortoises, and they let him be. And then I look at these modern phenomenons, this modern phenomena with human beings, where you have men like purposefully avoiding the dating scene, including yours truly, and many people call this, they refer to it as MGTOW, or men going their own way. And then you have other people who try to hide under the LGBT banner as if they're allowed to be included, you know, with that freak show, and they'll call themselves asexual. If you're MGTOW, you're more likely to be red-pilled, quote-unquote, or on the fringes of the alt-right, or at least strong conservative. And I find that if you're asexual, you're probably more on the liberal spectrum of things. But we have all these different species who are turning away from their duty as human beings to reproduce, to carry on their seed, to create a new generation. And I'll say it now, I'm a hypocrite, because as I see the biological imperative as something very, very important, I'm still not in a hurry to act on it myself. I'm disgusted with women and their hysteria right now, where they can crush a man in one news cycle based on him French kissing her 30 years ago or giving her drugs that she proffered off him 20 years ago. But if they had sex after he gave her the drugs, then, he emotionally manipulated her. Well, bullshit, I say. You don't fucking know that. You don't get to say that. You weren't there. And so, I'm fairly certain that penguins and tortoises don't engage in that kind of hysteria in the animal kingdom. But it is sad that some creatures forego the necessary step of reproduction to leave some legacy, to further themselves to the next stage of what their legacy will be. But it is what it is, because where we're at right now as a society, I don't find any women trustworthy or even particularly deserving of the values and integrity that I could bring if I allowed them in. And it's funny because all the years at work, I've seen women come and go who tried to peer beneath the mask that I put up. And I'm not trying to build myself up as important. I'm not engaged in morbid self-fascination here. I just find myself relating to the penguin and the tortoise here. That they try to peer beneath the mask and try to understand me or feel my pain or understand, you know, why I shun their companionship. And yeah, I know I'm not anything special to look at, and my personality is that of an ogre to many of my former colleagues and peers. I don't care, but they still try to peer beneath the surface. And I will only let them get so far, but before I say, time for you to go. You don't get to see any further. Where were you when I needed you 10 years ago, when I was fresh out of high school, bitch? You know, and I don't care if it's petulant. I'm not interested in the dating scene. And no matter how many times people try to get me, paint me in a corner as either a virgin on one end of the spectrum, and on the other end of the spectrum, a sexual predator, a serial groper. Ooh, I'm gonna get you. I'm gonna get you, girls. I'm gonna get you. You're a fool if you say either. Okay? At the same time, I don't have to prove it to you. You're not inclined, you're not owed a peek into my bedroom and anything that's ever happened in it. You understand? But you can go on making yourself look foolish. I would like to hope that this woman who I talk to in my personal life, who fawns over me far more than I have over her for, I would say, about 2 years, that maybe something can come of that someday. But I've never totally let my guard down again. But if it doesn't happen, if it never happens, if I have no offspring to carry on my works and my will and what have you, at the end of the day, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, you can't go and force your legacy on somebody. I mean, you can't force yourself on, because then you're everything that they say you are without understanding where you're coming from, you know, what lurks in the dark corridors of the bachelor, the willing bachelor. Maybe I will end up like the tortoise or the penguin. I don't know. But I will know that it was by my choice. And I am okay with that. It just gets to me because, I mean, with the animals, they've been domesticated and they've been raised in these enclosures and in these habitats that are false, that are artificial. You know, Lonesome George had one of his caretakers massaging his genitals while laced with fluid from a tortoise. And I think with the pheromone on her hands, she was able to get a reaction out of him. This is a turtle fondler now. She was able to get a reaction out of him, but he couldn't keep it. He had never been around another female tortoise of his own kind, another pinta tortoise. And that is so sad. And it's funny because I remember the latest article after Lonesome George died, after 40-some years of them trying to find the right Mrs. George for him, they said they don't like to talk about it. It was too painful. They tried to save this poor tortoise's, species, and it just never worked out. That is so sad. So, yeah, that's where my head's at on Valentine's Day. And no, I didn't get you any chocolates or flowers or fucking cards. Okay. Now, on to far more important things. Joining me in just a few seconds will be Ben Arzate. You've heard him on previous shows where we interviewed the Cannibal Cop. And also, we talked on my first YouTube stream about the prescription drug dilemma and the possibility of legalizing recreational drugs, or medicinal at least. He'll be joining me for the next hour or two, and we'll be talking about one of my favorite subjects, books, various kinds that we've been reading, and yeah, this is the Bipolar Book Review. All right, coming up next. Hi, everybody!
Hello.
Joining me now is Ben Arzate. You might remember him from such classics as The Interview with the Cannibal Cop. And, by the way, did you happen to read Gathering of Evil?
Yes, I did. I did put it up, have a review up on Cultured Vultures, so if anyone wants to check that out, they can. Like Jeremy, you told me you can't access the site for some reason, but my full thoughts of it are on there if anyone wants to check it out.
That's your website, or is it just one you contribute to?
I'm a contributor to it.
Right. Well, the deal with Gathering of Evil, before we get started here, just briefly as an aside, I thought that Gil Vallée was a stellar interview. I mean, that's the kind of interview that you, as a podcaster, that just, you know, you're amazed that you that could land in your lap at all. You know, a guy who's grabbed national headlines, you know, that rips your emotions one way or the other. You're either outraged about the implications of the charges against him, where he was accused of wanting to torture, disembody, and eat his wife, or the thought crime element of it, which we also covered, where, you know, he says, well, hey, it was just a fantasy, and it was never to be anything else but a fantasy, and my wife didn't understand, you know, my darker fetishes, and so I was, you know, compartmentalized with the whole thing. Either way, that whole headline was going to grab emotions from everybody across the spectrum, right?
Right.
But with Gathering of Evil, his first fiction foray, I mean, I thought it started well enough with the couple who's bored and they're really kind of deviant. They've done all the kinky sex that they can, you know, they're sordid imaginations can muster. And so they decide, you know what? We're going to kidnap a woman and torture them, eat them, and not only that, but we're going to film it and sell it as a snuff film to the dark web. Now, it's like, what do they call it? Fiction? Is it art imitating life, right?
Right.
And my problem with Gathering of Evil was not the rampant torture and everything, but it's the fact that this couple who was, you know, kind of leading this ring of this torture ring via the dark web and setting this whole thing up, they kind of fade into the background as the author becomes so zeroed in, so, you know, has like a bullseye on the torture to a degree that you never get to, you know, come up for air as he describes the torture, right?
Right. And, you know, minor spoilers here, but that was sort of my problem with it. When it did get nasty, it got really fucking nasty, which was what I was expecting. But the ending was just so kind of anticlimactic. It's like they get tortured and they get killed and then it ends.
And that's literally all it is. It's literally torture porn. The another problem I had, and this is something else I pointed out to Gil after reading it, and he was actually pretty receptive to the feedback, is that whereas some authors would at least allow the female antagonist to almost get away, you know, flirting with escape and then only to be cut off and recaptured or something, you know, they would kind of toy with the heroine and the reader. They never have a chance. They never have a chance to even flirt with escape. And I felt like there was a missed opportunity there. But it's, you know, it's his first book, so, you know, he'll grow. But I was disappointed with that a little bit, you know?
Yeah, and it's like I told you that it felt like the first half of a longer story. So I'm kind of hoping like the sequel he announced does a lot more with it.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, by the way, did you happen to catch that live stream earlier with on Baked Alaska's channel with Andrew Anglin of the Daily Stormer and Sargon of Akkad?
No, I don't pay attention to Baked Alaska, honestly.
I don't know if you're into that kind of thing, the YouTube like drama, but me personally, I'm fascinated with it, and it's just it's amazing how Sargon just cannot win an argument against any of the more prominent alt-right figures.
Yeah, I can't imagine like debating Andrew Anglin at all. He strikes me as someone who operates entirely in bad faith.
Well, yeah, he does. He when he's trying to get Sargon to say Kike and, you know, all this other stuff just for the sake of trolling, then of course he's arguing in bad faith, and yet Sargon still comes off as if he's arguing in bad faith as well. And if you think that that sounds extreme, you should have heard Tariq Nasheed and Jared Taylor a few days ago. I just find it fascinating that there's always more interest in the more extreme personalities, you know?
Right. Yeah, but that would probably be a pretty funny confrontation, because I did watch a debate with Jared Taylor and R.A. the Rugged Man of all fucking people, and that was a train wreck.
The deal here is that it's not that black people are actually deviant. They just need to get the hell out of my country.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, Jared Taylor, he's like, I don't know, he's like an alt-right Mr. Rogers. It's really kind of cringy.
Yeah, it's kind of weird because he like seems like a genuinely nice guy, but he does hold like those ideas that when you think about them are pretty fucked up.
Can you imagine if his daughter brought home a black guy, like she was dating or something, and I mean, that's not out of the realm of plausibility. He says, "My God, get that monkey out of my house, for God's sake."
He's dirtying up the floor. Somebody get this monkey out of my house.
I'd actually like to see that happen.
I'm sorry. I'm not trying to make this more awkward than it needs to be. I guess I'm just breaking the ice. I'm breaking that fucking ice right in. I talked a few weeks ago with author Chris Sicknewsom. You heard that one, right?
Yeah, that was a really great interview, and actually read one of the books that they recommended.
High Wind in Jamaica, right?
Yeah, it was really good.
What's that about?
Talk about that one.
Huh? What's it about?
It's basically an adventure story where the title comes from the fact that a bunch of kids, British kids, were born in Jamaica, right after slavery is abolished there. And there's a hurricane that destroys their home. So they, their parents send them back to England. But when they, when they're heading back to England, they accidentally get kidnapped by some pirates who aren't all that competent. And one thing that's interesting about it is, Sicknewsom kind of compared it to What Are the Flies? The thing is that, most of it is goofy and humorous, but it has some, really dark moments with the kids, and some very, one of my favorite parts in there is the oldest girl. She has this, self-awakening while she's on the pirate ship. She becomes just, totally aware of herself. I don't really know how to describe it, but it's a really great scene to read. It's this idea of at some point, you just have vague inclinations of who you were. And then one day you just remember everything clearly and realize yourself acting in the moment.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think that moment came for me in ninth grade. I was a freshman in high school, and you just kind of, you're more aware of everything you're doing, whereas you used to be totally in the moment, but not above it. And when there is a sense in your teenage years, I guess, that you kind of become aware, on an instinctual level, hey, I exist. No, wait, I really exist. And it's a weird feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely very odd. Because apparently, Richard Hughes, he set out just to make a fun adventure story. I mean, even back then, adventure stories were a little quote unquote darker than we would expect now, especially ones that are generally aimed towards kids. Mm-hmm. But him, he was relatively young when he wrote it, 28, 29, and he didn't have any kids at the moment, so he didn't have any romantic notions about how kids act. So he wrote them what he viewed as realistically. And so because of that, there was a controversy over it, because that people thought he wrote the kids aggressive, maybe a little too darkly. Mm-hmm. Because this is a bit of a spoiler here, but there's one moment where the pirates are robbing another ship, and they tie up the captain of that ship and throw them in the hold with the the oldest girl, and the oldest girl doesn't speak English, the oldest girl speaks English, but the captain of the other ship doesn't. So he's looking at a knife and looking at her, basically trying to tell her, hey, can you cut me loose? But the girl thinks that he's going to try to kill her, so she grabs the knife and kills him. Mm-hmm. And she's very traumatized by it in a very realistic way.
She basically is becoming a pirate. I mean, essentially, right? She's learning how to blend in.
Well, she's almost becoming more aggressive than the pirates, because the pirates on there, they make threats, but they aren't really threatening. They're a little bit incompetent. There's a whole scene of them landing in Cuba, I think it is, and selling off the things they find. And the whole thing ends with all of them getting drunk and passing out all over the place.
She's upstaging the pirates at their own game then.
Right, and there's a part in the ending where it comes out that I don't want to give away because that's a really, really great twist at the end.
Now, when was this written?
It was written in, I would say, like, late 20s, early 30s, something like that. Mm-hmm. So it does predate Lord of the Flies by quite a few years.
Hmm. How familiar are you with morbid books?
I'm relatively familiar with them.
Have you read anything they publish?
Yeah, I've read a few of their books.
Have you heard of Buds?
I've seen that around, but I haven't read it.
Oh my god, it's incredible, dude. It's definitely the best horror I have read thus far this year. It's by James H. Longmore, and it's about this guy. I can't remember his name right now. It's something like Widry, or it's a weird ass name. But he basically invents this time machine, little handheld time machine, out of a sex toy, a dildo, and he manages to go back, I think, 3 milliseconds into the past. That's as far as it'll let him go. And he discovers this whole other, you know, society of creatures that are like conjoined twins, only taken to the, as far as you can possibly imagine, conjoined twins being deformed. I mean, like faces like sticking out of chests, faces between the legs, smiling, winking faces on the tips of dicks. You've got arms jutting out of kneecaps. If you've ever seen the movie Society, the last 15 minutes of that, the giant orgy where they're all like blob, like gelatinously blobbing together, merging together, it's kind of like that, almost. Just a totally shameful orgy of sensation, you know what I mean? Have you seen that movie?
I've only seen part of Society. That's one that's been on my to watch list because I'm a fan of Screaming Matt George's special effects.
Right. But what does this guy do? But him and his wife, they open a brothel specializing in these conjoined peoples, offering them up as sort of a kink show to everyone, from the priests to police chiefs.
That sounds like a pretty great book there. Sounds very like Cronenberg-esque.
It is very Cronenberg-esque. And, you know, it is the most, oddly enough, for a publishing company of more like Morbid Books that specializes in taking the lowest road possible, totally lowbrow. This is surprisingly literary for one of Morbid Books' offerings. I think it's better than even Murderland or Humanity is the Devil, which, you know, kind of earned Morbid Books their name, you know, Garrett, off the backs of Garrett Cook and Jordan Crawl. I think that Buds actually, it transcends the appeal of those two. It's surprisingly literary, and apparently the author, James Longmore, has a lot of screenwriting credits, you know, in his resume. What's another book that you have curated here?
Let's go with the one I just finished today. I just finished reading Anti-Oedipus. The subtitle to it is Capitalism and Schizophrenia. It's by a French philosopher and a French psychologist, Gilles Deleuze and Félix Guattari, and I probably butchered the pronunciation on those names. I have very mixed feelings about the book because, one, it was a French philosophy book written in the late 60s, early 70s, so it's very turgid and full of full of poorly defined jargon and skips around a lot and has a lot of like wordplay that doesn't translate well into English. The idea of it is, like the name suggests, is it's going against the idea of the Oedipus complex that, because Freud came up with this idea that how literally he meant it is a bit up for debate, but he had this idea that all boys grow up with this idea that they want to claim their mother as a sexual partner and rebel against the authority of their father by killing them.
Yeah.
And they are going against this idea because they believe that it, one thing they put forward is the idea that the desire to commit incest comes from its prohibition. The idea that our desires in society are so pushed down that we're told, like, you can't do this is like, oh, I didn't even know I wanted to commit incest until I was told I couldn't. And like I said, I don't fully understand all of it. It's very difficult to get through. I probably should have had to read like more of their influences first, because they do have a heavy influence from Marx. They're very influenced by his idea, by his theory of history, and they are sort of going against both Freud and Marx, but also integrating their ideas into theirs. One of my favorite parts of the book that was actually quite good and quite easy to read was their critique of psychoanalysis, because the way they view it is Freud had this idea of the subconscious as a sort of theater, something that reflected the world and played it out in their minds. And they go against that idea. They view the subconscious as a factory. They use the term desiring machine a lot. Their idea is not that desire is not like an illusory thing that comes from a lack of anything, but the desire is a real force within a person. Let's see, what else is there to say about it?
I want to dwell on that a little bit longer. A desiring machine, and back up and explain that to me one more time. The subconscious is a desiring machine.
Yeah, their idea is that rather than desires just being reflections of the lack, use hunger, for example, their idea is not that the desire for food would not be just having a lack of food, but that the desire for food is like a real driving force within someone.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and they use a machine or factories as their metaphor.
Mm-hmm. What was the next part? Do whatever you got to do.
Yeah, it's very difficult to get through, because like I said, it's very difficult to understand. I probably have to read like a supplement to it to fully grasp it.
Mm.
That's like something I really don't recommend reading unless you have already read like Freud, Marx, Nietzsche, Lacan. It's one of those books that you have to have a lot of like background information to really get it.
Mm. What possessed you to want to read this? Just the seeking of knowledge, or do you have some sort of collegiate academic background with this, or?
Somewhat, I did major in psychology, and so I am very interested in it. The thing is, though, psychoanalysis, which is what they very much go off of, has been out of favor for a long time. They take a more, I suppose you would say, positivist view. Psychologists today and psychiatrists, they're far more interested in doing like actual research instead of the psychoanalysis that Freud pioneered. That's another thing the book gets into, is what they oppose psychoanalysis in favor of what they call schizoanalysis. The idea being that it's meant to push back against the various forces of society that suppress people's desires, which is definitely a point of contention. The idea that they believe that desire should just run free without any regard.
Well, that's where we're definitely at now. That's where we're at now in the state of the world, right? I mean, if it feels good, do it, right?
One could argue either way in that sense, because even in that sense, one could argue that people's desires for things are manufactured by the idea of you need to, this feels good, so do it, even if you don't, if it doesn't feel good for you, there's something wrong with you. But yeah, they make no bones about the fact that schizoanalysis does have a political agenda behind it, which is another problem. There's the idea that they have this idea of schizophrenia as a result and as a way of rebelling against repressive forces in society. And of course, if you've ever known anyone who's schizophrenic or severely autistic or anything like that, you know that's not what they're fucking doing.
They were trying to weaponize schizophrenia when this was written, basically. I mean, they're trying to politicize it. Not weaponize, but politicize. And, I mean, most schizophrenic people, like, in the most extreme cases, can't even function in society without considerable help or medication. I mean, so I think that they were maybe, that was a case of addressing that issue when, without having, at a time in history where there wasn't quite that much data on it yet, right?
Right, and you can, in some ways, given the time frame, you can kind of understand why they would almost borderline valorize people with mental illnesses like that, because for the longest time, they had just stuck people who were severely mentally ill, and maybe even not that severely mentally ill, into institutions that were a little better than torture chambers.
That's true, yeah. Do you think that maybe there's like a communist undertone to this book, possibly, or anarchist?
Probably more anarchist than communist outright. They definitely are very much against the idea of the state. They are heavily influenced by Marx's theory of history, but they are also very critical of the Soviet Union and places like that.
You know, there was an accompanying term for Oedipus complex. It wasn't just sons and mothers. It was also, there was also a term for daughters and fathers called Electra complex. Did they address that at all?
I don't believe they do. In retrospect, I'm actually surprised they don't, because they are very critical of the idea of the phallus being the center of psychoanalysis, but they never really address the idea of like Electra complex or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. You've read some of Anderson Prunty's work, right?
Yes, I have.
What have you read by him?
What was it called? It was one of the works in the Bizarro Starter Kits. Was it the one about the slugs, that the slug attack one?
Okay, Slag
Attack, that's what it was called.
What was it?
I think it was called Slag Attack or something like that.
Yeah, okay. It had several combined stories or whatever.
Yeah.
Set in the same universe, I think. Well, one of the best fiction books, like hardcore underground Bizarro, you know, I think it's a toss up for me between his first ever, I think, The Beard, which is just one giant absurdist nightmare, that surprisingly got a warm Simpsons-ish tone to it. It's very humorous. And also, the let's see, My Fake War, which kind of reminded me of Enemy Mine, with this guy meeting this alien, and they kind of, I mean, it's exactly as the title implies. They're kind of making stuff up as they go along, you know. It's imagining things that aren't there, but then those things, when they're not tended to, tend to have consequences that are far-reaching, if I recall correctly. Even though you can't see anything, if left unignored, whatever one the alien claims to be seeing, you know, it has consequences. But the title that I'm going to drop on you here from Anderson Prunty, though, is a departure from both of those and everything else he's written, and it's called Squirm With Me. It's one of his most recent. You probably heard of it, right?
I haven't heard of that one yet, no.
Okay. Well, Squirm With Me by Anderson Prunty, and I think it's put out by one of his presses, or his wife's presses. It's either Grindhouse Press or I can't even remember what the other one is now. I'm so far removed from that community, but it's called what is it?
Addle.
Yes, it's one of those. Addle, exactly. So Squirm With Me is about this really, really down on his luck indie author who's never even been up on his luck, really, to be down on his luck. And he has one book to his name, and he didn't make a lot of money at it, maybe just, you know, in the initial release. And he's getting, like, trolled relentlessly by this kid on the internet who's, like, posting, you know, nude pics of underage, you know, girls or something under his account after he got hacked. Now, at the time that this happens, his loser brother shows up and is kind of putting him up to all these things that he's not comfortable to do. And he even convinces him to vandalize this house in a downscale neighborhood. It's really incredible. It's a departure from the super weird, bizarro-ish, you know, tone that you usually see Prunty writing about. And it's just surprisingly realistic. Aside from the Lebowski-ish, you know, antics that we see, it's all could conceivably happen in this reality, you know, the real world. So I thought that was an interesting, you know, departure for Prunty. What do you got next?
Let's see. I'm looking through my Goodreads here. I guess I'll discuss another pretentious French book. It's A Man for the Asking by Catherine Brillet. Have you heard of her before?
No.
She's most known as a director of very controversial movies like Fat Girl and Anatomy of Hell. I recently read her very first novel that she published it when she was 16, and it was actually restricted for sale for people under the age of 18. It's called A Man for the Asking. It's written in a very poetic style. The plot of it is very simple. It's about a guy who's a player, basically. He sleeps around a lot, who meets this girl who he, like, instantly falls in love with. But this girl, and he finally, like, gets a date with this girl, but this girl doesn't want to have sex with him because she wants to make sure that that he loves her completely. And it's a very simple plot, but it's very stylistically driven. There's a lot of, like, a weird wordplay in it that I think were attempts to translate puns that don't really translate into English. The one that comes to my head is the phrase, "Phoenix rises from the ashes."
That would be the Phoenix, like, right? I mean,
Phoenix, penis.
Okay.
Combining the two. The pussy will use, as in pussy willow. And like when he, like the whole like later 3/4 of the book is basically just them, like sort of like a cuddling, but not really having sex, not even really cuddling, just kind of like fucking around. But like I said, it's written in a very like dreamlike and poetic way. And the way it ends is the guy cuts his stomach open with his own penis, reaches into his under his rib cage, pulls out his heart, and stuffs it in her vagina.
He gave her his heart. That's romance.
Yeah, you can kind of tell that a kind of pretentious 16-year-old wrote this.
That's symbolism taken a bit too literal. I mean, that's...
Yeah, exactly.
Anybody could do that kind of symbolism. That's not a challenge. So, yeah, I see what you mean, that a 16-year-old could write that. Go on, I'm compelled here.
Yeah, it's... It was, it's out of print now, but you could find it pretty easily through, like, in a library like I did. Mm-hmm. And it's, the used copies are pretty cheap. People aren't seeking these out, especially, like, Burlett's, like, hardcore fans. Even Burlett's hardcore fans seem to admit that it's that it's just juvenilia that probably shouldn't have even been published. But if you want, like, a good laugh, it's probably worth it. It's almost like so bad that it's good.
See, I was actually looking around here hoping that maybe I could just find a random free PDF file here online if it's that old. When'd you say it was written?
I'm pretty sure it was published sometime in the mid-70s, I would say.
Yeah, no dice. Looks like I might have to go on Open Library or actually go down to my real one. I wonder if they would have it. Not a lot of demand for pretentious French literature where I'm located, but was there any more to that plot? Or
not really, no. I only checked it out because I like kind of some of Burlett's movies, but I think if she's written a few books, the only other one that's been translated is her novelization of Anatomy of Hell. It's called Pornocracy, and it actually has an afterword by Peter Sotos in it, so that looks pretty interesting.
We've all heard the story of the Tower of Babel from the Bible, where they want to build a structure that will shake the heavens, that just, you know, reaches into the heavens, right? You okay?
Yeah, okay. I'm here.
Okay.
Here.
I thought you fell or something.
No.
This
might just be my chair.
Okay.
It's old.
So the tower reaches into the heavens, or that was the plan anyway. And God, offended by their, overreaching ambition, struck the tower down and scattered the peoples, and that's why we have foreign languages today, and that there's a divide in culture and language. If you are to believe, the scripture, as I do, you probably don't. That's okay. But there's this book now out. It's a fantasy, but it kind of reimagines the Tower of Babel as if it's a tourist destination in, modern day, or as closest to modern day as I can tell by judging by this book. This is called Sinlin Ascends, and it's about the eponymous hero named Sinlin honeymooning with his wife at the Tower of Babel, which she's always wanted to see in person. Same as you might want to, trek down to Stonehenge or, go to the Cayman Islands, And something happens and they get separated. And he always seems to be a step behind her as he's trying to track her down. He enters into this these corridors, this resort within the tower, which is like labyrinthian. and he's forced to act out a part in this ongoing 24/7 play that seems to never end. He happens by this other woman who has somehow, if I recall, she's broken some law or maybe even killed one of the fellow actors. It seems to escape me right now, but the offense is so great that they are held in this chicken wire mesh cage that's dangling over the sides of one of the windows of the tower for several days. It's about the size of a bed, this cage is, a child's bed, as it's described, and they're cramped in there, and the woman is told that she will have to go for exile. Now, what that translates to in the law of the Tower of Babel, which I guess has its own set of laws, much like the Vatican City does, is that she's to be branded. In which case, if she ever tries to re-enter the Tower of Babel, they'll know by her brand. Now, Sinlin...
Sort of like the story of Cain?
Yeah. Oh, Cain, who was forced to dwell in the forests forever, away from civilization, yeah. And they actually go through with it. And she bids him to go on and find his wife, and that's as far as I've gotten, but... It's actually a pretty captivating story. Apparently there's a follow-up story, so it may even, the author may even intend for it to be a trilogy, but it's Sinlin Ascends by Josiah Bancroft. And so that's where I'm at with that one. That one's still in progress. What about you? What do you got?
Let's see. Let's go next to The Journey to Vapor Island by Robert Stark, another one I reviewed for Cultured Vultures. So Robert Stark is another podcaster. He does a lot of like very wide subjects. He's has a very like wide interest, especially in terms of like art and movies and politics. The Journey to Vapor Island is about this nerdy Jewish kid named Noam Metzbaum. He lives with his mom in New York City, and he goes to an inner city school, and even though he's like bullied all the time, he's a very Ignatius Riley-esque character. He's as much of a nerd as he is, he's somewhat intelligent, also very pretentious, and thinks he's destined for great things. And he goes to this academy called Chadworth Academy. He meets this girl, a blonde Jewish girl that he falls in love with at like first sight, and he's like constantly being bullied by the quote unquote Chads, who like most people know that if in internet slang that's basically like jocks. And eventually this girl is nearly raped by a bunch of the Chads, so he grabs a sword and cuts them up basically. And he spends several years in prison, and that's like the first half of the book. In the second half of the book, he gets out of prison, and he finds that a character named Roger Blackstone, who he's almost like Trump, except his political ideas are very different from Trump. Some of his ideas include things like mandatory psychedelic usage, basing immigration off of attractiveness, like reworking cities into these futuristic cities. And that's when he comes to find that this girl he was in love with and is still in love with after being in prison all this time is on a place called Vapor Island. And while he's there, he also discovers that he became sort of a cult hero for killing these people, almost like Elliot Rodgers. Became a hero to like internet incels.
Wait, did he? I didn't know that Elliot Rodger became a hero to anybody. Did he really?
To people who call themselves incels, yes.
Wait a minute. What are incels? You're stumping me with the internet meme slang. I'm baffled.
Yeah, that's another thing about the book. It's very heavy on like internet memes and internet culture. Incel means involuntary celibate. they're like guys who like are another slang for them is permavirgin. They're guys who have a lot of trouble with women, but rather than either accepting it or trying to improve themselves, they just rage against society. And
oh, so what the Bizarro community authors accuse me of being then, basically.
Basically, yeah. Except these people genuinely are quite awful. Like, before the incel Reddit board got... I mean, the incel Reddit board, the reason that got banned is because one of the reasons was because a user there went on another board and basically... in a sneaky way, asked how he could get away with rape.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and not to mention there were apparently...
I hope no one, I hope no one gave him tips. God almighty.
No. And another thing that happened is apparently, like, some of them went out and actually, like, catfished people on Tinder. Like, they would put photos up of attractive people when the women showed up, and they'd be very different. Just, like, record themselves, like, verbally abusing these women.
Man.
So basically, they were genuinely a lot of really awful people. But in this, but because in Journey to Vapor Island, because he had gone after people who were in fact genuinely pretty awful and disliked by a lot of people, he became like a cult hero in general. He goes to this Vapor Island place, and one thing he's been doing, like, the whole time is writing, like, in a journal in his manifesto, like, his own manifesto. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that they had taken this manifesto and basically turned this island into almost like a theme park based on it. Like, most of the later three-fourths of the book takes place in a place called the Erotic Emporium, which basically took his sexual fantasies from his manifesto and made them into attractions. And going back to, like, it being very heavy on the internet memes thing, there's actually, like, a cult of Keck in there, people who wear frog masks and worship the Egyptian god Keck. There is a lot of sex in it, like, to the point it almost could have been sold as, like, an erotica book. It's a very funny book, too. It is basically a satire. The moment that hooked me into the book, I guess you would say, is towards the beginning where he goes into a Japanese bookstore and he buys, like, a manga version of The Diary of Anne Frank. And when he gets home and starts reading it, he... is so attracted to the manga version of Anne Frank that he starts jerking off to it.
Oh.
And then his mom, and then his mom walks in and catches him.
Now, Anne Frank is the girl who hid in the cellar in Germany, right? Or is she the blind deaf girl?
She's the girl who lived, hid in the attic and wrote a diary of her experience. And he... You know, like, when he's doing this, he's talking about his fantasies of rescuing naked Jewish girls from the cash chambers.
Awkward.
So it's a very politically incorrect book as well.
I love it, though.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I think you would really like this book.
Why I can't find it on Amazon?
It was self-published on Lulu.
Okay.
And I don't think it's... I don't know what the relationship between Amazon and Lulu is.
Mm-hmm.
But, you would have to go to Lulu to get it.
Okay.
And it's... there's even a scene in the book where he... during a dream, he gets visited by the guardian angel, Chatelet.
Oh, that is awesome!
Yeah, it's... It is, like I said, it's very set satirical. It's sort of pokes fun at both Republicans, Democrats, and libertarians.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Blackstone is Noel Metzenbaum really admires him, but everyone else thinks he's just a fascist loon, which again is the parallels with Trump. Everyone thinks he's a fascist and just a lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, it's Ryder's ideas are very different. And in the book, you know, but at the towards the end of it, Roger Blackstone actually is president and is like shaping the world into what he wants it to become.
This sounds like a badass book, man. I gotta get this.
I've spoken
to Robert Stark a little bit first because I wanted to see if it was going to be on Amazon. I kind of have this thing where I'm neurotic for some reason where I like to only buy from Amazon because I don't like my credit card to be out there, you know, for different, you know, just anybody to have access to it, you know. But also because I wanted to understand, I went to his website and he talks about the alt-left, but not in a condemning tone as I'm used to with people on my side. But he talks about it as something to break away from the traditional left that is perverting and destroying American culture. He sells it as if it's apart from the Antifa mindset, which I loved.
One thing. The whole term alt-left, it started getting used to refer to Antifa and so forth when Trump used it, but that's not what it originally meant. Mm-hmm. Originally, it was from people who had some sympathy to certain alt-right ideas, but departed with them very heavily, especially on economics, and they were on board with the idea of creating a sort of alternative left that sort of disregarded both the Democratic Party line and the social justice warrior line. Mm-hmm.
Would you consider yourself alt-left?
I'd probably consider myself post-left, which is a whole nother thing.
Post-left? Man, you're busting out all the terms on me. I'm behind. I'm still thinking about Kekistan. I'm stuck in 2016.
Well, I'm in 2061.
Wow, yeah. So I'm going to talk about a book that I did not like. All this heaping all this praise on all these different authors. I'm going to tell you about one that I won't say you should avoid it, but there were mistakes made. It's called A Life to Waste, or you might know it as, I don't know, $2.99 to Waste. It was by Andrew Lennon, and it's about this complete loser, not unlike the character of Squirm With Me, only more of a loser.
We've been talking about a lot of loser narratives.
Yeah, I know. It's almost like a pattern, you know?
Why we like loser narratives so much.
It's a mystery. But this guy is constantly smoking pot and drinking. It's his life. He gets up and he does it. He goes to bed and does it. And it's what he lives for. He has a fist fight with his stepfather, and he gives the guy's mom an ultimatum. It's either him or me. She chooses her son. He leaves. She blames him for the stepfather leaving, but she still loves him because he's her son. Now, at this point, things start to happen as this guy just sinks deeper into the morass of substance abuse and, you know, being a couch potato and everything. And he starts hallucinating, or what he thinks is hallucinating. And we never come back to these hallucinations again for the rest of the book in the way they're presented. Because his mom gets abducted in the same way as his next door neighbor was abducted, with so much blood left behind that they don't think that either of them survived. Then the guy starts setting, you know, up little, I don't know, wildlife cameras, I think, and little traps to try to catch the intruder or to, you know, trip him up or something. He starts to get active and quit the substances in this, you know, race to rescue his mom or what's left of her. And then the author makes this crucial mistake upon the revelation, you know, of what, you know, as we're starting to follow the breadcrumbs of what's going on, the guy stumbles upon an ice cream truck where what the author describes as Bigfoot is loading the bodies of bloodied and broken bodies into the back of the ice cream truck. He follows the ice cream truck, and suddenly the Bigfoot is described as a human being, and he has all these mutated bodies on the floor in the corners, chained up in every direction in this abandoned warehouse. It's sloppy writing, man. It is sloppy writing that I hoped was leading somewhere fruitful and valuable, but it's just mistakes all around, because he goes from describing it as Bigfoot, unironically, to describing him as like a backwards, like Hick-type character, like almost like Sloth from the Goonies. You see the disparity there. It probably, yeah, it was probably a first draft that he didn't pay any more attention to.
It sounds very confused from what you described.
Yeah, I was confused, and I didn't see any point in the hallucinations leading up to and directly after the initial kidnappings. There was no revisiting those hallucinations. They just happened. The whole thing, the core falls out of the story and never comes back around that time. And yes, the guy goes on to have his happy ending, and he saves his now deformed, like, limbless mother. It's just an ugly story that he must have seen a bunch of horror movies and thought that he could write that. However, I do wish the author luck in the future. If he hears this, maybe he can take these criticisms to heart and, I don't know, go to some secluded cabin and really dredge up something useful from his subconscious or his imagination. You know, don't give up, but try to write something better than this. You're tired, yeah, I guess.
Okay. The next book I want to discuss is it's called The Coldest Winter Ever by Sister Soldier. As the pen name kind of implies, Sister Soldier was a rapper from back in the early 90s. She even performed with Public Enemy. She's featured on a couple Public Enemy songs. She's not a bad rapper, but the problem is her albums are mostly spoken word instead of actually rapping. But she does have one pretty good song, which is it imagines this future scenario where David Duke becomes president and slavery becomes re-implemented. It's a pretty cool song, very Public Enemy-esque. The Coldest Winter Ever, it's about a girl named Winter she's born in the hood in New York City to an extremely rich drug dealer who eventually moves them out of the hood and onto Long Island into a mansion. But then the FBI arrests her father, and most of the book consists of her basically trying to get on her own feet and trying to make money to get by, and trying to stay out of the system, since she's under 18, so the Child Protective Services keep trying to put her in homes. It's partially a coming of age story, partially a crime story. There is a pretty interesting part where Sister Soldier writes herself into the story, but it actually works pretty well because Sister Soldier was a community organizer in New York City, and I'm sure Winter is based very much on the kind of girls that she came across when she was working with impoverished Black children, impoverished Black teenagers. It's basically a book where it's a very, I guess, a picaresque plot where she's going around and things seem to be going her way, but then like the bottom drops out at some point. And of course, part of it is things beyond her control. Part of it is her own fault. And a big part of it is her own fault, because she's very like concerned with, you know, I can only trust myself. So she never builds any like real lasting friendships and gets fucked over whenever she thinks she can rely on someone. And there's quite a bit going on in it. There's like the part, like I said, where she actually meets Sister Soldier within the book. It's basically like she sort of sees Sister Soldier like go around and talk to prisoners and raise money for people with HIV and so forth. There's a plot running forward where she meets a gangster named Midnight, who she like has a huge crush on from the very beginning when she meets him, and he's like her dad's most trusted dealer, but he eventually gets out of the game and moves out of New York City. So a big part of the later half of the plot is her trying to get to him, but she never does, which seems like it would be pointless, but it does work very well within the story.
Is it a case where she kind of reality sets in, like, just because you dream it doesn't mean that, you know, it's going to come true, right? Is that that kind of thing?
Yeah, there's an element of it to that. There are, like, parts where she makes a lot of, like, big plans that end up falling through. Like, a big part of it is that Winter is, in fact, a relatively intelligent and clever and has, like, a lot of talents that she never uses because the way she was raised, both by her parents and both by, you know, the people she hung around with, that she can't, like, just go straight and get, like, a real job or anything like that. She has to, like, come up with these hustles. So it's the kind of book that gets put under the quote unquote urban genre, which I honestly hate that term, but it's sort of in this like a almost in the same vein as like a Iceberg Slim and Donald Goines.
Okay, it sounds like young adult. I mean, it sounds like young adult.
It is. I've seen it marketed as young adult. If it is, it is. I mean, it is written very simply, and because it's from her point of view, so she speaks very simply and in slang. But to me, it's just like a mixture of a crime story and a coming-of-age story. It didn't really read like she had set out to write something that was to solely appeal to young teenage girls, even to like young teenage Black girls.
Something tells me her father probably gets the book thrown at him, like, legally speaking, right?
Yeah, in the book, he, of course, gets thrown in jail, and at some point, I can't remember the reason why, but he ends up killing a couple other prisoners, which gets him, you know, sent to prison for even longer. Mm. And there's even, like, one interesting part in the book where she goes to see her father, and the prison guard a prison guard there basically flirts with her. And keep in mind that this guy is like in his 30s and she's like 16, 17 at this point. And when she rejects his advances, he tells her, yeah, he's not here, he got sent somewhere else. And she suspects he's lying, but then just leaves because she doesn't want to deal with him, and then later finds that for certain he was lying, and he was there the whole time, and she could have easily gone in and saw him. So that's another aspect of the book, this idea that her like impulsiveness is a huge part of her own downfall.
Well, you know, that sounds like a lot of the way that a lot of correctional officers operate today these days, I hate to say.
Yeah, it doesn't. It's very critical of like the whole like hood culture that praises gangsters in a way, but it's also very critical of, you know, the police and correctional officers and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, we all know there are bad cops, you know, but I think correctional officers, right. for some reason, correctional officers seem to be the worst. I think that being exposed to that element all the time and always having to be worried about, you know, getting, you know, shit and piss thrown at you through the bars or any number of other things, you know, somebody trying to run a scam or somebody communicating information, you know, through the cells or gang activity, it probably hardens you to an unearthly degree. But
yeah.
COs yeah. seem to be worse than cops on a consistent basis from what I've, you know, seen into that world. But
yeah, and even though it, like Sister Soldier very clearly takes the viewpoint that drugs are very harmful to the black community, she obviously has no love for like the drug war, because that's a major part of the drug war. This I can't remember what the legal term for it, but like if they suspect that like your car was used in an illegal activity, they can just take your car, and you have to be the one to prove that that it wasn't used for any illegal activity.
Civil asset forfeiture.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, Antifa's getting hit pretty hard with that right now in real life.
Yeah, that's something I can't say I'm a fan of at all, regardless of who it's used against.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, if they can use it on them, they can use it on us, right?
Right. That's one of my big problems with it. This, like, if you try to pass something into law, the fact is, it might be used against people you don't like, but when the people you don't like do get into power, which will happen at some point, they will use it against you.
So you should. That's probably why emotions should not enter into discussions when you are occupying, you know, office. I mean.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to use one example on the top of my head, like they like put taxes on cigarettes to dissuade people from buying it and then make laws where you can't sell Lucy's. And then, well, when someone breaks that law, they get thrown down and they might very well get choked to death.
Yeah. I think I'm going to end as far as my reading list here. On the Montauk series, how much do you know about this?
The name Montauk sounds familiar, but I don't know anything about that, honestly.
Okay, it's the Montauk Project series, written by Preston Nichols and Peter Moon, and it's been published by Sky Press all these years, starting back in 91 or 92. Okay, here goes nothing. Are you familiar with the Philadelphia experiment?
Refresh my memory, because I thought I read about that, but I can't remember anything about it.
Hang on, I think it was during World War One. No, it was at the height of World War Two. Okay, the Philadelphia experiment, they say it's alleged, but there seems to be some documentation that it happened. Maybe not in the way it was described to have happened, though. Basically, the Navy was investigating and experimenting with Einstein's unified field theory. They used the USS Eldridge in an experiment to cloak the ship in and basically make it invisible, okay? You with me so far?
Yeah.
Now, allegedly, this ship, when they were able to cloak it, it actually reappeared in I think a Virginia or New Jersey or New York harbor, and then quickly reappeared in Philadelphia, where it started, if I recall. And men were fused to the deck of the ship. They were fused, like, you know, arms embedded in the walls, and some of them had heads stuck in the walls, and they suffocated and all this stuff. Because they were playing with, you know, matter on a, you know, subatomic level, I guess. Now, you with me so far?
Yeah.
It sounds outlandish, of course. But not half as outlandish as what comes later with the Montauk Project in the years after World War II. After, with Project Paperclip, Nazi scientists are brought under the into the fold of the Navy and everything, and there's this base in I think Long Island called Montauk. Oh boy, and I'm probably gonna bungle some of the information here, but there's just so much to keep up with this thing. What starts as, you know, a deviation from Einstein's unified field theory and men being embedded into the USS Eldridge's ship and hull and everything. From there, it spreads out into all these esoteric areas very conveniently so that you could write multiple volumes of books about it. Wink, wink, you know?
Yeah.
From there, it branches out into time travel, UFOs, alien abduction, cloning, mind control. It conveniently explains why thousands and millions of people disappear every year off the face of the earth. Okay, we've got MK Ultra, which, along with Project Paperclip, was actually real. There's no disputing that. I mean, there have been lawsuits. Bill Clinton came out and admitted it in 1995 that MK Ultra was real and should not have happened. So this we have hard evidence that mind control experiments happened with LSD and brain programming with different radio frequencies and everything. I mean, there is even talk, and it starts with Montauk Project Experiments in Time, and then followed by Montauk Revisited, where Preston Nichols, who worked at the base as an engineer, he kind of fleshes out some of the things that were left unexplained in the original volume. Then from there we go out to Pyramids of Montauk, and the mystery starts to get more elaborate, and he starts to remember things conveniently that he didn't remember before. Like what happened to some missing time that he and some other people had while working on the base. Okay, now it's clearly this gets so outlandish that it's impossible to believe, although I think that parts of it are true. The thing is, it gets to a feverish point where Preston Nichols actually tries to sell the reader this idea that there have been multiple timelines, okay, of Earth due to all this playing with time travel. There was
the Mandela effect.
Yes. He actually tries to sell the reader on the idea that the original timeline was the Judeo-Christian God's creation of life in the universe. And when Adam and Eve deviated, they were cast out from the Garden of Eden, and we got a second timeline. Does that mean that a human seduced Eve in the garden to eat the apple? I don't know, because there are reptilians known as Dracos that are interwoven into this multiversal cosmic like Nazi associated plot that runs through the currents of the books. See what I'm dealing with here? I mean, and then you get to Encounter in the Pleiades, and they talk about being aboard experimental UFO crafts that are like
straight out of Doctor Who with the TARDIS, you know, where you go into these UFOs and they're as big as mansions inside. I mean, this is some crazy shit, man. And then I get to book 5, The Black Sun, Montauk's Nazi Tibetan Connection. And get this, there were actually a few thousand Tibetan men who fought alongside the Nazis, and there was a circle of men in a basement of one of the Nazi command centers. They died in a circle wearing green gloves, and there were odd runes painted on the floor in the center of this circle that these Nazi Tibetans died in. And I mean, it just keeps going, man. There are like 3 other books associated with this. There have been documentaries about this. I don't know what to believe, but I know what not to believe about the whole thing. It's fascinating. It's reeled me in. Unfortunately, a lot of these guys who have been associated with this story or whatever it is, they're starting to die off. They're starting to get older, and they're starting to lose their sharpness, their mental aptitude, right?
Right.
To the point. Well, I'm sorry to cut you off. I've been talking forever, but to the point that Preston Nichols, the author who was in on most of this from the beginning, he's actually starting to come around and say, I didn't say it was all true. I just said it could be true. See, I think that there's some senility, and so he's starting to not, the chips are starting to fall away to where he doesn't remember everything he said, right?
Right, that definitely sounds that way.
Well, what do you think about all this?
It does sound like he took things that were definitely true and ran with it, because it really is no secret that there were quite a few people within the Nazi Party who were very big on esoteric occultism. Mm-hmm. So the idea that, you know, there were like people who very heavily into that, that's pretty much fact, but some of the things you described there sound a little bit unlikely. Have you ever read the book The Men Who Stare at Goats?
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, all of that is true. It is true. The CIA and government organizations have tried to experiment with occultism, like the Men Who Stare at Goats. The title from that came from the fact this research group who tried to basically kill goats with just their minds. So, yeah, there's definitely at least grains of truth to that, but it does sound like he kind of takes that and adds in, like, his own speculations and what are probably rumors at best, and just like runs with it.
Hmm. Well, another problem I have with these books, at least later in the later volumes, is that the author Peter Moon, who was there to substantiate and chronicle Preston Nichols' story, he's kind of a ghost writer who uses his actual name, so to speak. He writes for the, you know, for the things that Preston Nichols maybe can't word as eloquently. Peter Moon
is his real name?
No, Preston Nichols. There's Preston Nichols, and then there's also Peter Moon, who is helping Preston tell his story. They're co-authors. In the later volumes, Peter Moon actually kind of deifies or makes heroes out of individuals like Aleister Crowley and L. Ron Hubbard, who I think are pretty despicable, to be honest. It even talks about a secret book, like a book that's legend at this point among Scientologists, called Excalibur, that only a few people have actually read, and it's supposed to unlock the truth of existence, and if you can use it as a weapon once you've mastered it or something. Not unlike Dianetics claims it can do for you. Whatever. But I think Peter Moon was a little naive back in the late 90s to make a hero out of L. Ron Hubbard, considering what they did to that one girl who had roach bites on her by the time they were finished with her. They wouldn't let her see a real doctor. They drove her 5 hours out of the way to go see a Scientologist doctor. And, I mean, you know how anti-medication those people are. It's just Scientology is not unlike the Mafia, based on what I've seen. But
William S. Burroughs was actually a Scientologist for a short time, and he got the fuck out of there pretty fast.
Exactly, yeah. And William S. Burroughs was also into the esoteric, the occult, the fringe sciences and whatnot. And yeah, it's fascinating. The fringe science stuff is fascinating. The esoteric stuff, all that, you know, I could devote an entire afternoon to that stuff. But and he believed in orgone boxes. You've heard of those, right?
Yeah, that's to go back to Anti-Oedipus real quick. Wilhelm Reich was another like big influence on that. Like his ideas about why the masses like desire repression.
Yeah, Wilhelm Reich's name actually comes up in one of the Montauk books. But did you know how they're in Sweden? They say there are these no white zones that are only for Muslims.
Yeah, like supposedly, I don't know how true it is, but supposedly there are parts of Sweden where the pro-Islamist Muslims have gotten so bad and thick that even police won't go there.
Yeah. Well, after World War II, there was actually a territory in Montauk or in Long Island, New York, near Montauk, that was designated explicitly for the Nazis, who were there on assignment as part of their conditions with Operation Paperclip, to tell the U.S. government what they knew, what they were working on, you know, back home, you know. There was actually a no-go zone as far back as the 50s and 60s, explicitly for Nazis.
So basically, like, they said, okay, we'll let you live here and do whatever the fuck you want as long as you cooperate with us and tell us what we want to know.
Yeah, and others weren't allowed in there. It was the, I guess it was the first modern no-go zone, you know. I want to leave. Do you have any more books?
Because
I got one story. I got one story that I want to impart. One last story about Montauk that is kind of makes the whole thing legendary. Before we get to your last pick or however many you have, I want to tell this one story that kind of it's the biggest. It's the biggest fish in the big yarn that is the Montauk legacy. So basically, this guy named Duncan Cameron was supposedly working with the researchers there with this chair that, you know, it had all these things that you had to hook up to yourself, but you would, like, lay in this chair, and there was this screen in front of you, and whatever you pictured, with as much detail as you could think of, it would appear on that screen, or however little detail, you know, it would appear as you pictured it in your head on this screen. You could only do it in this chair, hooked up to all this shit. Duncan Cameron was able to conjure things out of this screen and bring them to life, and you know, eventually they would fade. Now, according to testimony from Preston Nichols and several others involved in the Montauk Project, he actually imagined a can of beer, a Budweiser, on the desk of his the general or sergeant he reported to, and sure enough, the Budweiser can appeared, if you believe this, and the general or sergeant, I can't remember, actually said that it tasted better than a normal can of Budweiser. This was what Duncan Cameron was able to do in the chair. He was the only one who was this skilled at using it and conjuring things from it. One day, because there were a lot of younger men that were being tortured, and their minds were actually being fragmented intentionally through torture of all different kinds, so that they could put the mind back together and make them Manchurian candidates. You've heard that term, right?
Yeah.
Now, Duncan Cameron, along with Preston Nichols and several other key, people involved in this shit, they decided one day, you know what? This is enough. This is sick. This is getting out of control. We've got to shut this down. They had a plan where allegedly Duncan Cameron would conjure a monster from his subconscious that would destroy the base, that would, or at least, you know, frustrate their plans going forward, that would stop all this, that would make them think twice about doing this. He conjures this monster that's like Bigfoot almost, but they mention as an example, it's like Bigfoot, but it's also like a creature from some old 40s or 50s horror movie, like, I don't know, Forgotten Planet, or It Came from Outer Space or something. And it was it didn't appear where he imagined it appearing, though. It appeared somewhere else on the base, and it proceeded to level equipment and destroy entire floors, and other things that he had conjured came through or something. So you got total chaos on the upper levels, and eventually Preston Nichols is sent into where the main generator is. As chaotic as things are, and the monsters are roaming free or whatever, and Preston Nichols has to shut the thing down, but it's not shutting down when he does. He's pulling plugs, he's disengaging this and that, you know. And finally, he takes an axe to the main components, and finally the thing shuts down. As outrageous as this is, in the second book, Montauk Revisited, a photo of this monster years after the fact, supposedly it manifested, you know, like a ghost later when Preston took the photographer back there. Okay, are you still with me on this?
Yeah, this is, even if this didn't happen, which I doubt that it did, it does make for a great story.
You wish it did happen, right?
I mean, sort of. If something like that happened in real life, I'd be like watching my back all the time, but
yeah. So they nicknamed the monster Junior, but in the second book there's a photo at the beginning in the foreword that supposedly, you know, the photographer took of it, and supposedly their theory is that the monster manifested because they went back there later after it was, you know, pretty much a shell of a building. They have filled in all those little underground tunnels, though, that you can clearly see were once accessible. They filled them in with concrete, and they have even had guys out there with equipment scanning what's underground. What do you call those people with those devices when they scan for gold and stuff, you know?
I don't know what those devices are called, but those people are just basically treasure hunters.
Yeah. Well, they have had people out there with that equipment monitoring if there's anything underground, and they can pick up, you know, like chambers of a certain size and length still under there. So, I mean, you know, it's the military, it's the Navy, it's the government, whatever. Of course, they're going to hide and secure what's theirs, but there's just enough mystery there that makes you fall into Preston Nichols, you know, testimony, however outlandish. In any case, it's made for a remarkable story, and if you want to follow that, go ahead, man.
Yeah, I might have to check out at least the first book in this series.
Yeah.
Any more on the Montauk project?
No, that's it. I'm on the Black Sun right now. I'm about halfway through it, and I've still got about three or four more to get to. That I haven't read yet, but that's as far as I've gotten with the whole thing. So, go ahead.
Okay, so I guess I'll bring this back to something a little more earthy with a book called No Longer Human by Osamu Dazai, and I probably butchered that pronunciation. This book, I would say, it's most comparable to something like The Stranger by Albert Camus. In fact, the original Japanese title is something like disqualified from being human. So probably a more accurate translation would be something like the disqualified. Basically, it's a semi-autobiographical novel about a young boy who he grows up in a fairly well-off family, but since he's young, he has this feeling that he is disqualified from being a normal person, probably due to like a depression, anxiety, something like that. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he's molested by the maids growing up doesn't help. And the story is basically him, growing up, trying to deal with school. One thing he does is when he's growing up, he takes to basically playing the clown, because he believes that hides the fact that he's disqualified from being human. There's a part in it where he fails to make someone laugh, and that person is like, "Will you stop messing around all the time?" And that like nearly gives him like a complete mental breakdown, because it's the idea that he's been found out, that they see behind him. And as he grows up, he deals with a drinking problem. He his problems with women, there's a part in it where he tries to commit suicide, and his friend finds out that's what he did. His friend doesn't seem all that concerned. He's just like, "Don't do that. Society frowns on it."
Oh, come on.
And he comes to this sort of realization that, society is in fact nothing more than like individual people interacting. And that gives him like a bit of comfort, because it's this idea that society is not this great looming, crushing force over him. It's just, the people around him. And, this person was saying society frowns on it only because, he obviously had a distaste for the idea of him committing suicide. I'm not really doing it justice, because it's one of those books that you really have to, even in translation, it's just a really beautiful book. It's very depressing, but it's also very beautiful. And it eventually ends with him basically isolating himself entirely in like a country home that his family has, and just dying alone there. And there's an ending, there's like an epilogue where we find like we meet like one of his ex-girlfriends years later, and we sort of find out that despite everything that he despised about himself, the people around him, most of the people around him, actually did care very deeply about him. It's just that, he, because of how he viewed himself, he was incapable of seeing that, and could only see the people who just said like, "Oh, don't commit suicide. That's distasteful." But it's a really great book that I really highly recommend. I think it's it doesn't matter if you don't like Japanese literature or not. It's something I would say, just read this. It's amazing.
As someone who's lost a friend to suicide, that is so true, because people, when they get to that point, they feel hopeless, and they feel like there's some exchange that they feel they're not getting from their fellow man, and then you go to their funeral, and there's just, it's their people are lined up out the door to pay their respects, and it's just, you can't really control how people are going to care about you. People will care about you to the extent that they're capable, and the extent to which they understand what caring about someone is. So a lot of people, they get caught up on, "Why are you not me?" Or, "Why can't you read my mind? Why can't you, show me affection the way I need to know, the way I need to know it, And that's not healthy. people care about you to the extent that they can, and that they understand how it is to be done. And that's just all you can expect from people, is to care about you the way they want to and understand that they should.
Right. Yeah, I think you put that very beautifully. A book like that, some people would say that it is depressing, and yeah, it is very heavy and depressing in many ways. But I suppose for me, since I actually have dealt with depression, reading a book like that, I guess it gives me the feeling that, you know, sort of that I'm not alone. I'm not the only one who feels this way. And there is, like, there are ways to work through that, work through it.
Yeah, you know, there, I mean, even I have some what I call gray days where I just feel like existence itself in every direction I look is bearing down on me to, you know, just, you know, give up. We all do. But if you just, you know, hold on, eventually, you know, it may be a day, a week, you know, or even an hour, or frighteningly enough, you know, maybe a few months, but eventually, you know, something is going to make you slip up to where you're going to forget that you were depressed. Like, you know, something will happen, I don't know, with a job, with a girl, with maybe that book, that cool book that you read last week, or somebody made you laugh on social media or at a party or something, where it's like, you know, you laugh or you're overjoyed, you know, or, and you know, it's almost like life says to you at that point, I got you. See, you thought you were depressed, but you're laughing. You know, and if you look at it like that, you know, it can be comforting.
Right. And to go back to the reference to Camus I made, it's the idea at some point that you can feel this way, but there's this idea like everything just seems like meaningless, but there's comes a point where I feel like if you work towards it, you can embrace the fact that the struggle of everyday life can in itself be meaningful, like that idea of Sisyphus, like the struggle to push the rock up the hill every day is enough to give you meaning.
Even if you never reach the top, I mean, yeah. At least you tried, right? But I don't guess that this, the main character of No Longer Human, doesn't kill an Arab like Meursault from The Stranger, does he?
No, but he does at one point make a suicide pact with a woman who does successfully kill herself while he fails. So I guess that's sort of the equivalent.
Now, what is he jealous, spiteful? When he finds this out, does he hesitate to join her?
Like, remember, it's a Japanese book, so they're very big on the idea of like face and honor, and at this one point they just come to this conclusion that they've dishonored themselves, so they decide to both make a pact to throw themselves into the river, and she manages to drown, but he washes ashore before he drowns.
Okay, so he tried to join her and failed. Yeah. Wow, I'm gonna check this out. You know, a lot of people, when you talk about Japanese authors, Japanese, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people name check, at least here in North America, they will name check Kobo Abe or Abe. I don't know how to pronounce that, but
Kobo Abe. Yeah, Abe. I have one of his books on my shelf, but I haven't read it yet.
I bet it's The Box, isn't it?
No, it's The Woman in the Dunes.
Okay, that's another good one for him. There's also Kangaroo Notebook, Secret Rendezvous, but The Box Man is what he's most known for, I believe. But Kobo Abe and also Haruki Murakami.
Yeah, he's another one who I have on my shelf that I haven't read. The ones I've read that I can think of off the top of my head are Ryu Murakami, the guy who wrote Audition. And Audition, that's actually, maybe it's the translation, but that's one of the rare instances where the movie was better than the book. I've also read Yukio Mishima. I'm a big fan of his.
Now, what did he write? He committed suicide, didn't he?
Yeah, he's infamous for the fact that he got, like, five people together and tried to take over a military base and convince the soldiers there to rebel against the Japanese government and restore power to the emperor.
Wow.
And when the soldiers didn't even listen to him, he just cut his belly open.
He wrote Faraway Runaway Horses. That was one. Yeah, it was part of a series, right?
Yeah, it's the series was called the Sea of Fertility series. I've only read two of it. The first one, Spring Snow and Runaway Horses. Mm-hmm. The Sailor Who Fell from Grace from the Sea, that's a really great book.
That's one I've been chasing for a while.
Yeah, definitely check that out. It's a great book.
Yeah, I think there was a movie, actually.
Yeah, there was a movie. I think they keep the plot the same. I haven't read it. I haven't seen it. But I guess they moved the action from Japan to England.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I've also read his essay, what's it called? Sun and Steel, which is another really great book. I really recommend, especially if you are like a writer or an artist of some kind.
He may have written that one the morning he committed suicide. Seems like he wrote something on the morning of his suicide. He wrote something. I don't know what it was.
On the morning of his suicide, he wrote the last book in the Sea of Fertility series. I think that one was called The Decay of the Angel or something like that. And he mailed it off to his publisher, and then he went and tried to commit this coup.
He also wrote Confessions of a Mask, where this guy wears this mask and he can't remove it, or something like that. Something about identity, right?
Well, Confessions of a Mask, I haven't read that one in full yet, but that was one of his early works. It's basically Yukio Mishima was gay, and so basically that one was basically about the fact he had to hide the fact that he had no interest in women and had to pretend, you know, he was something he wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Wow, man, we've really covered a lot of ground in an hour and a half here. I really appreciate you coming on, dude. I'm thinking about, first of all, that we should make this a regular thing and call it Bipolar Book Report.
Yeah, I'd definitely love to do that. I had a great time with this.
But also, I'm thinking we need to bring in a female perspective and add, are you familiar with Teresa Pollock?
I recall her seeing her name around, but I don't know her.
Well, she used to run the Bizarro Book Club on Goodreads, I think. But she's a pretty cool ass chick, and I think maybe we could bring her into this, and we'll call it the Bipolar Book Report, and maybe we can just do these every now and then when we've loaded up on a few more books.
Yeah, I'd definitely be interested.
Kick ass, dude. Yeah, we are both feverish readers, you know. Maybe someday we'll actually get some writing done, the both of us.
Yeah, I do have I don't know if you're still recording this, but I do have a big announcement regarding that will be coming soon.
Oh, but not now?
No, I want to wait a little bit before I make the announcement.
Okay, great, man. Well, whatever it is, congratulations. I look forward to hearing whatever it is. Thanks for coming on, Ben. And yeah, man, we're officially book buddies.
Definitely. And I'm happy to be. This is a great time.
All right, later, buddy.
All right, talk to you later. We'll be right back.
fucking autistic.